Here, you should check them out on the web. I want to thank you so much for listening, and let's hear some of that Charlie Parker.
Is proud to present The Harder They Come as part of the KBOO at the Clinton monthly film series. The Harder They Come is a 1972 Jamaican crime film. With dreams of becoming a successful reggae singer, a young Jamaican man, played by Jimmy Cliff, finds corruption from his record producers and the drug pushers they're connected to. Again, that's The Harder They Come, Thursday, July the 9th at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
As sure as the sun will shine, I'm gonna get my share right now. What's mine? And then the harder they come, the harder they fall. On and on.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 17th annual Pickathon, July 31st through August 2nd. Pickathon is 3 days and 7 stages of performances by a variety of bands such as Tune Yards, Shabazz Palaces, Ty Segall, Leon Bridges, Freakwater, and dozens more. Pickathon takes place at Pendarvis Farm in Happy Valley and features weekend or single day tickets, as well as wooded camping, food trucks, and local beverages. A full list of artists, stage schedule, ticket prices, and transportation options can be found at kboo.fm/pickathon2015.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. It's 9:02. Time for Political Perspectives. Here's what we have coming up for you this morning on KBOO. Host Roberta Hall speaks with Mary Christina Wood, Faculty Director of the Environmental and Natural Resources Law Center at the University of Oregon School of Law, about her book, Nature's Trust, Environmental Law for a New Ecological Age. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on The Dirt Bag, host Glenn Andreessen and guest Jim Gilbert talk summer pruning, watering in hot weather, and apricots. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking where it says Donate Today. Thanks for tuning in to KBOO today.
Welcome to the Health and Healthcare Forum. I'm Roberta Hall. In this series, we examine health from a number of perspectives. We look at health in the context of the environment, the social environment, the natural environment, looking at the resources that support human life, healthy human life in particular. Sometimes we include lectures, but most often we have conversations with people who are doing things of importance to advance health, some with broad public policy and some at an individual level. Doing this series has enriched my life, and I hope it enriches yours. Today is June 12th. My guest today is Mary Christina Wood. We are talking in a conference room in Eugene at the University of Oregon Law School. She is the Philip H. Knight Professor of Law and Faculty Director of the Environmental Program here at the University of Oregon. And we're here today to talk about a book that she published not very long ago. It's called Nature's Trust. It's extraordinarily logical, 15 chapters, 3 parts, and it flows. And what I noticed was that you have questions raised in the early chapters, and by golly, there's a chapter later on that answers it. So that was very satisfying. So welcome, Mary.
Thank you so much.
We want to talk about the book, but one of the things I would like to ask you, just because in starting out, you've been a law professor for at least 20 years, and you criticize certainly a lot of the statutory environmental law that was passed in the 60s and 70s. And I wonder if those laws and the whole concepts around them were what attracted you to law in the first place. Was that the case?
Well, actually, what attracted me to environmental law was just nature itself. I grew up on the Columbia River and spent a lot of time on rivers in Oregon and outdoors. That's what really created my interest and passion for the environment. When the environmental laws were passed, I think they were very good laws and very hopeful laws. It's just that they haven't been implemented according to their spirit.
Yeah, I wondered if there was a sense of frustration. There must have been over those years as some of these things kind of unraveled.
Yeah, I mean, just in my lifetime, I've seen incredible catastrophe on an epic scale in the environment, and teaching this body of law for over 20 years has been really eye-opening because I've rarely seen it actually protect that much. Occasionally, when citizens mount a huge effort, of course, it will come through and protect certain isolated resources in some instances, but the onslaught of damage and destruction that government is allowing pursuant to these environmental laws much overcomes those isolated instances of protection.
You talk a lot about the permitting process, for example, and I remember it's been over 2 years now, I believe, when an issue about coal exports came up and many people looked in the, this was with the DEQ, Department of Environmental Quality, and we looked up the charter and the, you know, the reason for it, and it looked like that agency could actually do something. But in the talking at the kind of informal hearing, it wasn't exactly a public hearing, but it was something fairly close to it, it kept being said, we don't have the authority, or we can only look at X, Y, and Z, and not the whole concept. That's very puzzling.
Well, it is, and that's what environmental law has really done to agencies. It's kind of sent them down huge gopher holes where they just operate in this subterranean land where everything is defined by statute in their world. And actually, the Public Trust is a separate body of law that originated at our country's beginning, and it imposes separate duties in addition to those statutory duties. And one is the requirement to protect basic resources that are essential to our survival. But the agencies have not done much with the trust. Many agency people don't look at themselves as trustees. They haven't educated themselves about the public trust. And so it's not surprising that they've become more narrow and narrow and narrow over time. And what they're using the statutes for primarily is to permit devastating actions.
There are bureaucratic processes that anyone wanting to do something that isn't precisely allowed can go through. For instance, at that particular hearing I was talking about, that kept coming up. Someone, industry, some entities as far as the business names go, and worldwide actually, kept saying, well, we've submitted this form, we've submitted this, we've addressed this question, we've modified our request, we've modified our plans for development at these ports. We'll do more if we need to. Just tell us what we need to do, and then we'll be good to go. That's the best example I have, I'm sure, because you cited many, many cases and many instances. You've read and watched and probably participated in hundreds.
This problem, this dysfunction, is really across the board. It deals with, you find it in mountaintop removal and nuclear waste policy and air pollution and water pollution and fisheries extinction and climate crisis and ocean acidification. You know, all across the board, you have agencies making decisions primarily to benefit industry, and you have those industries constantly at the table, constantly at the door. And for the citizens to mount the equivalent type of pressure on agencies, you know, overwhelms democracy. Citizens do need to wake up. They need to use all the tools available. But we also need to understand that the whole frame that really deals with these environmental impacts needs to change.
Now, I mentioned that there are three parts to the book, and the first pretty much lays out the background, what the problems are, some history of how it developed, and so on and so forth. And before I go on, though, I want to mention one other thing, and that is I really love the term you can't negotiate with a beetle, because it brings up to my mind the picture of these various attorneys for these industries negotiating with the beetle through a magistrate or maybe an agency would be more apt, and saying, well, but I've done this, I've mitigated a little. Can't you give in? Can't you stop ruining these forests and just move a little bit farther south or whatever it is? But the beetle won't move.
Yeah, the whole point of that phrase, and it was coined actually by Orrin Lyons, who's a magnificent thinker and writer, a native leader. But the whole point of that is that nature's laws really provide the boundaries for our own environmental laws. And if we don't comply with nature's laws, we will suffer the consequences. And that is where we're headed. So the agencies implementing environmental laws often lose sight of the bottom line, which is that ecosystems support our survival, and they require a certain amount of integrity to keep functioning.
That phrase just encapsulates it so well, and you have many others, and you cite phrases of other people. Doing the research and keeping the notes to keep all this straight must have been a long-term labor, I'm guessing, a few years.
It was a few years, and I always tell people I wrote the book for the public, and I wrote the end notes for the lawyers.
Well, the second part really gets into a lot of law and legal terms, and so I looked up some of these, and so there's an added advantage to reading this book besides about the subject matter, and that is you do begin to learn how the law functions, or at least you get to see into the eyes of a law professor or a judge or a justice or an attorney probably as well, and all the clerks and so forth that most of us rub shoulders with only occasionally. So, for instance, you use the term fiduciary a lot, and I have an understanding of it, I think, but would you just talk about that one a little bit?
Yes, the fiduciary concept really anchors the public trust doctrine, and the public trust doctrine is that relationship between citizens and their government with respect to natural resources. And so government is the trustee of all the natural resources that support our survival and welfare. And as trustee, it must manage those resources for our benefit, for the benefit of the citizens who are beneficiaries of that trust. And so the term fiduciary just means the government stands in a different role when it's managing natural resources than it stands, for instance, in a role with respect to criminal affairs or contracts or family matters or any number of other things. when government is managing natural resources, it is a property manager. It is managing the enduring endowment of the public for future generations. And I think legislators in Oregon and all over the place have just never thought of themselves that way. And so they don't prioritize environmental issues. But in fact, the public trust obligation goes back to the beginning of this country.
I began first to understand it in thinking about a will. A person leaves a will, dies, and there may be a trustee of that, and that takes very strong legal management. If the individual screws up or takes some of the money and does something with it that isn't for the beneficiary, they can get into big trouble. And I think many of them are watched very closely if there's any substantial amount of money involved at all. So that helped me to understand that it's something that needs very careful watching and is expected, and there are serious protections. So I love it. It's great.
Well, I think that people do, it resonates with people. Just because of that, we have these other instances in society where there are fiduciary relationships. And the public trust, I should point out, is nothing new. It's been around, again, since long before statutory law. It's just that when our statutes were passed, they took attention away from it. And so government officials, you know, again, don't view themselves as trustees, but as you say, they should be watched very carefully because they're actually dealing with an endowment that is our survival account, and they're dealing with wealth, with natural wealth. And so they ought to be accountable in the same way that somebody managing an estate is accountable to the beneficiary. And that's the whole logic of the public trust doctrine.
And the beneficiary is the public.
Yeah, the beneficiary is the present citizens, but also the future citizens. The point of the public trust is that this nature is a natural, enduring endowment that is supposed to last in perpetuity if our nation wants to endure. And so there's that constant attention to what will the future generations inherit? And that's really the strength of the public trust.
You have been listening to Mary Christina Wood, the author of Nature's Trust, Environmental Law for a New Ecological Age. You mentioned that Nature's Trust, of course, it's the title of the book. And sometimes, and this I found very fascinating, you refer to it as a doctrine, sometimes as a model, sometimes as a concept, a paradigm. Paradigm was mm-hmm. used a number of times as well. And I found that kind of fascinating too. It has all these aspects, and it depends on, in a sense, what the law beyond the statutes and the legal system itself will make it, whether it is a strong doctrine that is absolute, never to be questioned, a concept that has been used many times. You've cited many cases in the past, some going way, way back, and then, of course, I think most of us in Oregon and Washington, at least those of us above a certain age, remember the Bolt decision and management of the fisheries. And you say you're very familiar with the fisheries in the Columbia because that's where mm-hmm. you grew up. So that's no doubt a very, very important one. And you mentioned it a number of times. So it's all of these different things. This is a legal question I'd like you to talk a little bit about. How does an attorney or a judge or a justice decide how to phrase something? What parts of the law, since it's so huge, to draw on?
Yes, well, going back to what you initially said, the term I love to use is actually frame change, because the public trust principle is not only a principle in the law, but it's also a moral principle that many people find governs their behavior with respect to their families or children, protect the future for their children. It can be an economic principle or a business model. So it really extends through all segments of society because it is so basic and simple that our children and grandchildren should simply inherit the natural world that we had. And then when you zero in on the law and judges and how they apply it, there are many, many public trust decisions on the books. The challenge today is to take those key concepts, or what might be called the logic of the public trust, and extend it to problems that were never even imagined in the last century, or at the time when some of these landmark public trust decisions were written. And so, for example, today we're facing climate crisis. And if we go over thresholds because we put too much carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, there's no coming back from that. And so can we apply the logic of this principle as it was announced in the early cases in the 1800s to protection of our atmosphere? Well, of course we can. It doesn't even require that big a leap. It takes decisions that apply to water, and you say that another public trust asset is the air and the atmosphere. And that makes a lot of sense, and some courts have already announced that, in fact, that the public trust does apply to the air, the atmosphere, and the climate system. Unfortunately, here in Oregon, we just had a decision by Judge Rasmussen of the County Circuit Court saying that there's no public trust in air or atmosphere, or even water or wildlife or any of those things that are essential to our survival. So I think that shows you that the public trust principle is subject to interpretation by different courts, and by far the leading opinions have moved quite the opposite way towards the concept that the public trust really embodies all of the resources that are crucial to public functioning, and that is much more in keeping with the early cases and those cases that followed.
Now, this Judge Rasmussen, can that be challenged or taken to another court, and who would be the appropriate individuals or agency to make that leap or to ask for it to be reviewed?
Oh, yes. It already is being appealed to the Oregon Court of Appeals, and the Oregon Court of Appeals has already reversed Judge Rasmussen in his opinion earlier in that same case. And the Oregon Supreme Court just iterated a couple months ago in a leading case, the Wildlife Trust, for example. So I would expect that opinion to be very vulnerable on appeal.
Very interesting. Ongoing cases, and I suspect the public often misses them.
Well, actually, in this particular case, there's been so much publicity. It's the Oregon Atmospheric Trust litigation case brought by two teenagers here in Eugene, just trying to force the government of Oregon to make a plan to reduce carbon emissions according to what the scientists say is necessary to thwart catastrophic heating. And so these young women are just simply saying, government, do your job as trustees to protect the atmosphere that we actually need for our survival. I mean, climate disruption threatens all of the resources we rely on for survival. And so there's been enormous publicity, and actually on the day the court case was heard, school children and high school children flooded the courtroom and the street outside to show their interest in the case. It had enormous publicity, TV coverage, and public support for the youth plaintiffs.
Wow, and that's in Eugene here.
It's in Eugene, and this is part of a campaign that is actually was national and now international in scope that is spearheaded by the organization Our Children's Trust. And that organization has a website if you're interested in materials from these cases. And they are pursuing cases in many other states in this country, but also in other countries such as the Philippines, India, Uganda, Pakistan, and several others. So this is part of a global litigation movement that's coming about simply because the legislatures have sat idle while the planet is heating. And it's a sort of a last resort effort, turn to the courts and simply say, make the government do its job. Don't take the place of these agencies, but make them get to work on a plan. So in other words, the court wouldn't devise the elements of a plan. That's the agency's jobs, but you have to get them to focus on it and to work on it.
Very, very interesting. You mentioned in the book several cases that youth were bringing in various places, and that gets me to another term that I think lay people often bristle at, and that is standing. Who has standing? A judge can say that you don't have standing to bring this case for whatever reason. You don't have a proven injury, I believe is sort of the way it goes. But would you talk a little bit more about standing?
The standing is only an issue with respect to court litigation. So with this atmospheric trust litigation campaign that is spearheaded by Our Children's Trust, standing has not really been that much of a problem because, unlike statutory claims, where standing has proved a big hurdle in many cases, the trust is different. The trust says we all have rights to the perpetual protection of these natural resources. And we all, in effect, own a share in this endowment, not in the private property sense, but in the sense that we should benefit from it, and then the next generation should benefit from it. And so everybody really conceptually should have standing, all the citizens should have standing to bring these cases. And except in a few states where the law requires the Attorney General to sue on behalf of the public, standing is not really that big a barrier, I find, in public trust cases.
Oh, that's great. How does the Nature's Trust, the public trust of all these resources and all the work against global climate warming and the impact on the environment, how does it all relate to human health?
Well, there's a direct correlation between the environment and human health. Much of Nature's Trust, of course, deals with pollution and addresses why government agencies permit so much pollution. And it's a well-known fact that this pollution causes Americans severe health effects and death in a horrific number of cases. Climate, for its part, also has health effects. Certainly, doctors are focusing on increased rates of asthma and so forth. But actually, you can skip over health and just talk about survival, because it turns out that climate threatens many of the resources we need as human beings to survive. It threatens our water sources, our food sources. It threatens our shelter when there are extreme weather events. In Texas just recently, a number of people died from incredible flooding down there. And so sometimes we talk about health when we should really be thinking of survival, but climate has an ample dose of threats to both.
We want to talk about some of the things you've already mentioned, and they come up a little bit more in the third section, where you talk about transitioning. And one thing you just mentioned recently is the international aspect. And you admit that's kind of tougher because, of course, countries around the world, they have many different structures, some totalitarian, some democratic, or in name democratic anyway. We won't get too specific about that. It may be kind of a gradient of democratic. But because the public trust and Nature's Trust, as you write about it, it really does hold those who govern in a particular area responsible. There really isn't any other entity to hold responsible, I guess, because of international agreements that have often dealt with cases. For instance, the whaling issue, I believe, has mostly been dealt with at that level with treaties. But treaties are negotiated. There isn't necessarily at the beginning a right answer and a wrong answer. There's this country's answer and that country's answer. And this is different. So I'd really like to hear more about the international aspects and what you foresee as some of the roadblocks, for instance. As you mentioned, the atmosphere, and you said in the Philippines and various other countries that the particular case that started here in Eugene has gotten attention.
Okay, yes. Well, let's put it in the context of climate disruption, climate crisis, because I think that invokes this worldwide approach to an environmental problem. If we were all logical, we would say a treaty should just allocate carbon reduction responsibility among the various nations of the world. The problem is the treaties have not been negotiated to do that. And time and time again, the treaty negotiations have failed because the different countries don't want to give up too much in those negotiations. And so the public trust comes into play in the wake of the failure of international treaty negotiations. And increasingly, scholars are saying the public trust doctrine applies not only to domestic resources, but it logically applies to oceans and atmosphere and transport or migratory species. And the way we conceive of this is we just simply designate or call or describe different nations as co-trustees of a common asset. Well, with co-trustees of a common asset, each trustee is responsible for carrying out fiduciary duties of protection. So the model actually works pretty well on an international level to assign responsibility to protect the atmosphere, and that responsibility is held by every single nation. Now, the difficulty here is there's no silver bullet, and the international treaty approach would have been the most straightforward, but it's not happening. And so what we're finding is citizens now in different countries rising up against their governments, trying to hold them accountable before it's too late. And the public trust is providing a template for that citizen action. There's now these cases across the world, and they're sort of specifically pled in different ways, but they're all about government's obligation under the public trust, because this principle is fairly universal across the world. And so what citizens are doing in the Netherlands and other countries, Belgium, other countries in Europe, as well as some of the countries I mentioned, is just simply saying, government, pull down carbon emissions, make a plan before it's too late, before this world goes over the climate cliff. And if every country has citizens doing that, of course that's not the most efficient way, but it may be the most durable outcome, because you build domestic momentum for climate action in each country.
Let's hope it works. And as you say, it may not be the quickest way to, ideally, or as we might imagine, to get there, but the treaties haven't done it, and they've met for a number of years and always been, to this point anyway, been a disappointment. It's considered a great virtue, a step forward, if countries all agree that there is a problem and that they all should do something about it. Then as far as actually what, that's where it's been foundering. You have been listening to Mary Christina Wood, the author of Nature's Trust, Environmental Law for a New Ecological Age. She's been discussing her book, which was published in 2014 by Cambridge University Press, with host Roberta Hall. There's another big issue, and you have a chapter on that. I was very pleased. This was one of the things I was looking to see where it would come, and it did come. And there's a major chapter on economics, which of course is very close to all of this, whether it's a local issue and people want to have something going on that will provide employment for people, provide jobs now, and of course usually their concern is for the future. Sometimes that gets overlooked in the rush to obtain the industry in the local area or whatever. But economics is so important. We really need to talk about that.
And as you say, I devoted a whole chapter on that because I felt that environmental law was always accused of taking away jobs, you know, the spotted owl versus jobs. And in fact, that's pretty much been a smokescreen. It's not Not that environmental protection takes away jobs. It's a matter of which jobs will our society support. So when the spotted owl is protected, oftentimes the salmon are protected. When a corporation goes in and clear cuts a whole forest area, yes, they provide jobs, short-term jobs for loggers until the area is cut, but they devastate salmon fisheries sometimes, and so they cost jobs to salmon fishermen. And then they also cost the community in terms of their economic well-being for the future. And so I wanted to just rely on the magnificent literature now that busts the myth of jobs versus environment. It simply isn't true. We're facing what really many people call the next industrial revolution, the green revolution, so to speak. We have to remake our entire economy based on renewable energy. There's a lot of jobs there, but they're not going to be fossil fuel jobs. Fortunately, there's a rich body of literature that sets forth an economic vision completely compatible with public trust principles, and it provides a lot of hope for the future. But to get to that point, we just can't succumb to this fiction of jobs all the time in every debate over the environment.
You also mention things like the aspect of growth, that growth, again, is another measure that's often used of success. But as has been said, we can increase the gross national product if we have a major fire and everything burns down and then it's reconstructed. But that's not the way we want to measure our economy. But it's unfortunate that term has been given so much credence, and alternatives have been developed by other countries and played around with. But growth itself is still something that politicians hate to disparage. They say that whatever they're doing, it will provide growth, economic growth, meaning money changing hands for whatever reason. And then, of course, there are some really serious obstacles about human population and how do you manage it, or do you manage it, or must you never even try? China has, of course, received a lot of bad publicity for doing just that. So I know this is pushing it a long way, but I think it's something we should talk about.
First, with respect to the growth, there's just so much literature now challenging the assumption that we need to grow in terms of resource consumption. We live in a finite world, so it's ridiculous to say we can keep consuming resources. If that's the definition of growth, we'll just grow ourselves into misery. And so that can't be the definition of growth. Unfortunately, there are many, many economic thinkers that have developed visions for what they call steady state economies, which provide a more localized form of economic vibrancy, more local control over the economies, and more stability over the long run. The big growth imperative really came as a result of the big corporations, and that too is a huge problem for our world. The huge multinational corporations, of course, exert far too much power now in any democracy, and it is their profit imperative that I think politicians are echoing when they call for more growth, because in actuality, much economic literature suggests that jobs would be more stable in a more localized economy. And then with respect to population, I always think of population in combination with consumption. And here in the United States, consumption is not talked about much, but that is a major issue. We simply cannot maintain our levels of consumption and hope to have any sort of viable future. And so rather than just population, I think especially in this country and other wealthy industrialized countries, we ought to be talking about consumption and materialism as well.
It gets hard when you get to the nitty-gritty. It sometimes seems, I'm thinking about the size of houses. You know, on the one hand, in the Portland area, there's a lot of interest apparently in the tiny houses, you know, the really, really tiny houses, maybe 100 or 200 square feet. But at the same time, there are mansions developing. I don't know how people can possibly heat them. One has to wonder. 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 square feet and all that sort of thing. Those would have to be controlled in some measure, I suppose, by city planning. Is that a part of the law, how, you know, how a city grows? Of course, we know that in the 60s, the state of Oregon developed a new land planning board that changed things a lot, although, of course, as always, some people learned how to squeak around it.
Land use planning succumbs to some of these same problems that I've talked about in the other part of the book. The most important imperative, it seems to me, is protecting the soils and the agricultural lands and the forest lands. And so when you talk about the huge McMansions, the biggest problem, aside from their energy use, is going to be how they gobble up the agricultural land. And the fact is, we are moving into a different world. We're not going to be living for much longer, probably, in the same kind of secure world we knew. We have to now think about, and luckily cities are thinking about, food security and relocalized systems of providing food so that there's more resiliency against natural disasters and such. But you simply can't provide food security if you have no agricultural land to provide food nearby. And so really the most important thing with respect to this land use is protecting all the natural resources we have left, because many of them will be damaged by the climate chaos that is already sort of in the pipeline. We've got heating in the pipeline, according to scientists, significant heating, because of the carbon dioxide emissions emitted over the last century. We don't know of any way to just sort of vacuum those down. So we do need all the remaining resources, and those will be the real wealth, not the paved subdivisions.
You have been listening to Mary Christina Wood, the author of Nature's Trust, Environmental Law for a New Ecological Age. And that leads us to talking about water, of course, because water is so necessary when you think about rice agriculture especially, but many of the other foods that we depend on a big scale, need water. You have a section, I think, that particularly focuses on water.
Yes, water is really one of the resources that is going to redefine the way we live, I think. California is suffering this incredible drought. People are looking at the potential end to much of the California export of food. They simply don't have enough water to maintain what they've provided in the past. And so unless they get some desalination plants going very quickly, and it takes a long time for those to come on board, they're in a real crisis, and they're rationing down there. Well, food requires water. Oregon gets a lot of food from California. Oregon is also in a severe drought in many counties. And these are the things we must focus on. We can no longer afford to have our legislature, in particular, bury its head in the sand. It needs to start really coming to terms with the reality that more and more Oregonians are waking up to across the state.
The lack of water, and yet you drive down a road and often see these huge sprinklers, you could call them, that they're so giant, and they're drawing the water, Pleistocene water, I guess we'd have to say, that must be finite. We need to put our heads on that.
Well, we do, and water is a public resource. It's a public trust resource. So we've got our trustees that are supposed to be managing this resource. The writing is on the wall. There's going to have to be some management decisions made as to who gets the water. But we have our legislature breaking for their recess. Again, to come back to our trustees, many are just ignoring this worsening crisis. And that is a problem with our legislature, that they are focusing on other issues that are very important. They're doing very hard work in many areas. I don't mean to denigrate that, but natural resources are under a different clock, nature's clock. And they affect us all, and they're very important for our survival and well-being. So when it comes to allocating this increasingly scarce resource of water, we're either going to have a little bit of chaos, or our legislature and agencies will have to get to work on this problem very, very soon.
You talk about private property and public property, and it's the public property law that you draw on to a great deal. I think that's important because private property rights are often alleged to go against these concepts. Talk a little about public property law.
Yes, well, most people don't even know about public property rights because all they've heard about is private property rights. And so this country, of course, has private property rights that are very, very important to our sense of security, to our liberty, freedom from interference from government, and so forth. But there's another side as well. We all hold public property rights. Not all of us hold private property rights, but all of us hold public property rights under the public trust doctrine. And under that principle, the natural resources that sustain our survival are held in common by present citizens and future generations. And so these public property rights are actually antecedent, meaning they are the first rights. And then private property rights come after those. And in all of the leading cases on the public trust doctrine that deal with that interface between private property rights and public property rights, they all say that the public property rights are there and come before and are superior, but that there is an accommodation between the two. So the two systems actually coincide fairly well and exist alongside each other. But to ignore one or the other is simply not a proper view of title.
You also talk a little bit about Justice Douglas and people after him talking about a case that involves nature's rights, whether it's the animals that live with us, the plants, the water, the rocks even, and some cases in other countries, I'm told, have been successfully stated that way. And I believe that hydraulic fracturing has been opposed, or within a certain county or city or some well-defined unit, people have been able to say that on behalf of these stable resources of the earth, that they have rights to not be totally blown up, actually destroyed. My feeling was that you said this is very interesting and there are good reasons to favor a concept of that sort, but the case that you're making will stand on the property, public property rights, and that is, again, maybe a choice that a judge can make. We'll go for these rights and those rights and whatever makes a strong case in the public eye and in law, prior law. Am I on the right track there?
Yes. So what you were describing has been called the rights of nature, and that is a separate approach independent of the public trust doctrine. And the rights of nature basically is an ethical approach that is gaining a lot of attention in the public, and I think it's very good to speak in those terms to broaden the public's perspective of what's really going on. But as a legal matter right now, the rights of nature either have to be created in a community by an ordinance or maybe on a state level by some sort of statute or constitutional amendment. It's not like the public trust, which has 200 years of history. And so I feel that from the legal perspective, the public trust has that grounding already in the law. It's got fiduciary duties accepted and understood by judges that can hold agencies accountable. And the rights of nature is not at all inconsistent with the public trust. The idea is that the public trust presents citizens as beneficiaries, but because citizens are, of course, dependent on the full web of life for survival, really any sort of citizen interest would also capture the right of an ecosystem to survive and thrive. And so to the extent the two can be formed together, that's great. But I don't think a legal approach that misses the public trust would have the same foundation in the legal history of our nation.
That's a really important way to show how these things relate, and also how an individual trained in the law or a judge would answer the question and seek for the background. Well, in the last section, you talk about the moral compass, the third part of the book, which is, I think, chapters 12 through 15. We've already been talking about the moral compass, but just in talking about the structure of the book, I had mentioned that it has a logical framework. And unlike, I must say, many books on the climate crisis, this has not just hope, but it has a basis, something to do, something that can be done, a structure that can be built on. It isn't all about tears and crying and weeping. I think that's a good thing. So let's talk a little about the moral compass.
That section of the book draws parallels between the trust of law and religious and moral concepts of providing for one's children, providing for the community. And it was very interesting to me in researching the book that I found a trust concept in every major religion of the world. The idea is that creation is sacred and that humans are supposed to protect this sacred creation and pass it on and not destroy it. And I will be very interested in what the Pope comes out with very soon, I understand, in terms of his climate proclamation, because I think that we will see very similar language characterizing the earth and the atmosphere and the climate system as a trust. Many, many such pronouncements are already present in Catholic documents issued by the Pope over the last decade. And so by the moral approach, I think that's very important, because you can never view law as an isolation from other parts of society. And it's very important for the citizens to grab onto a principle that resonates with them as something that is right. And that is when citizens can use the law with passion and courage to force the action needed to protect the future of our children and grandchildren.
There's a statement here I want to read in, let's see, it's in chapter 14, and it's another legal term. The earth belongs in usufruct, I may not be pronouncing that right, to the living, but this concept, the usufruct, would you tell me if that's being pronounced right?
Yes, it is. That was a term that was in a letter by Thomas Jefferson. So this principle goes way back to the beginning of our nation and the early understandings of what a democracy was all about. And Thomas Jefferson wrote, "The earth belongs in usufruct to the living," meaning usufruct means that you can use the fruits of the land but not consume that which produces the fruit. So you could, you know, pick the fruit from an apple tree but not cut down the tree itself, because other people will need that fruit later on.
And that in a way reminds me, as your economics chapter did, of Schumacher's Small is Beautiful, because he talks about the problem when economists and say you can use up all these things, but they get into the capital. He accuses them of getting into the capital rather than the interest. He's an economist, so those are terms he used, but he also had a moral compass in that book.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it all dovetails, the public trust principle of law and the principle of natural capital in economics, which is really what you're referring to. And also the principle in religious life that earth is a sacred endowment that humans are the stewards of that sacred creation.
Too often we look at the little bit in the Bible that says something about dominion over the earth, but I recall the word stewardship being used a lot too in my childhood. Well, we've covered a lot of things, and as I say, the book is really something that will teach people a lot about the law, about the situation, and how we can actually work with it and overcome some of these problems. Thank you. Wonderful.
Thank you so much.
You have been listening to Mary Christina Wood, the author of Nature's Trust, Environmental Law for a New Ecological Age. She's been discussing her book, which was published in 2014 by Cambridge University Press, with host Roberta Hall. The Health and Healthcare Forum is produced by Roberta Hall and recorded with the aid of Joe Magner of Anabyte Electronics and Recording. Theme music was composed by Lori Childers and played by Lori Childers and Kent White.
John Scheck, host of Religion for Life. Alex McNeil is the executive director for More Light Presbyterians, an LGBTQ advocacy group in the Presbyterian Church USA. Alex is the first openly transgender leader of any organization in a mainline denomination, and he talks with me about next steps for LGBTQ justice in the church. Find weekly podcasts on kboo.fm/religionforlife.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 12th annual PDX Pop Now Festival, July 24th through 26th at Audio Cinema in Portland. PDX Pop Now includes a record fair, street fair, and two outdoor stages with performers such as Amber Moon, Blue Cranes, Long Knife, Mike Crenshaw, Nurses, The Stops, and many, many more. That's PDX Pop Now, July 24th through 26th at Audio Cinema, 226 Southeast Madison Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're tuned to KBOO, KBOO Portland. At 10 o'clock today, or 10:15, we're going to hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 o'clock on the Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen will be here with guest Jim Gilbert to talk about summer pruning, watering in hot weather, and apricots. And thank you again for being members. And if you would like to become a member, you can call, you can go to kboo.fm and click where it says donate today. And I think we're just going to get right to Air Cascadia coming right up.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, July 8th, 2015, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kboo.fm on the web. As it happens, today, United Airlines computers down. Back on track now, but down earlier. Stock market, another computer glitch, down.